I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan.
Welcome, Jim. I thought we'd talk a little bit today about ISIL. It's not going away, and it seems to be that we're hearing different things happening in different areas. One of the things that popped up since the last time we talked was this Khorasan group. I like how some of the media called it the Kardashians, but one of the controversies is, you know, this is just a branch of Al-Qaeda, and they decided to name it after the region that they were from. What is the relationship between all these little groups, ISIL, Al-Qaeda? You know, how do they all fit together, and are they just all branches of Al-Qaeda? I remember reading Al-Qaeda means basically the base or the foundation. So, you know, are all these just offshoots of Al-Qaeda, and they grow up on their own and go out and cause problems?
Short answer is yes, but it gets a little more complicated than that. 10 years ago, Al-Qaeda decided to franchise itself, and I assume we forget. And they basically encouraged existing Islamic terrorist organizations to adopt the Al-Qaeda brand. And there were basically good, I hate to use the word, business reasons. You know, it made sense from an organizational, propaganda, and logistical. You know, I mean, as you point out, you know, Al-Qaeda is Arabic for the base. And that was the original idea behind Al-Qaeda, not to be the criminal mastermind, you know, something out of a James Bond movie, but basically an organization that would pool contributions, you know, establish a contributor network, and then distribute the money, information, training, and what have you. And they've been fairly successful at doing that. However, the problem that Al-Qaeda had starting in Iraq in 2004, when the Islamic nationalists there, and they'd always been there, Saddam had tolerated, as many Arabic dictators had for decades, they tolerated terrorist groups in their territory as long as they did not do any of their dirty work in their territory, which is why there were so many Al-Qaeda, Islamic terrorists always coming out of Saudi Arabia, which for a long time did not have any internal Islamic terrorist problems. Anyway, what happened in Iraq was that you started another round of this, who is more Islamic than thou? This has been the bane, as it were, the curse, one of the many curses of Islamic terrorists and fundamentalist radicals for centuries. They start off united in purpose, in methods, recruiting, et cetera, world brothers in death here. But then there's a competition, you know, who is more righteous? And of course, this is common in all religious, you know, extremist groups. You know, there's always a bit of a, even if it's subdued, there's always an undercurrent of, you know, well, who's the most righteous among us? When birds of a feather get together and they're religious enthusiasts, they'll basically measure it by, you know, who is the most religious, et cetera, et cetera. The problem it first manifested itself in Iraq when it became known that bin Laden, Osama bin Laden, was writing letters, some of which were captured, electronic copies were captured, to the head of Iraqi franchise, which has now mutated into ISIL and the Islamic State, to cool it with the mass murder of Shia. Now, as a matter of course, all Sunni Islamic radicals consider Shia heretics, which is worse than being a non-Islamic or people of the book, a Christian or a Jew or something like that. The worst possible thing you can be is an apostate, heretic, and what have you. People like that are supposed to be killed on sight, et cetera, et cetera. No negotiation. This is why you have this enormous and long-lasting enmity between Iran and, which is all Iraq, all Shia, and the Sunni Islamic world, which is about 80-90% of all Muslims are Sunni. Another reason for that Shia thing, by the way, which a lot of people don't understand or are not aware of, is that Shiism was adopted in Iran specifically to annoy the Arabs. The Arabs had always had this attitude, sometimes it was very obvious, and a lot of times it was just, it was there, that while all Muslims are equal, Arab Muslims, because Muhammad was an Arab and the Quran, the Holy Scriptures were written in Arabic, and you're supposed to study and read it in Arabic, and what's your native language, they're more Islamic than thou. And this has been a sore point among, in the Islamic world for over 1,000 years. Now, normally it's kept under everybody's cool, you know, let's not make, you know, a thing about this. But when you get into Arab extremism, it does become a thing. Now, the as 2004, 2005, you know, in fact, the base, the headquarters, Al-Qaeda, are to this day are suspected of being the ones who leaked, as it were, the location of the head of the Iraqi Al-Qaeda so that he can have a smart bomb dropped on him. Whether that's true or not, you know, it's never been confirmed. But it sounds like the sort of thing that Al-Qaeda would do because they've been known to discreetly rid themselves of troublesome, you know, subordinates, as many organizations do. The franchising continued despite this. In fact, after 2008, it was assumed that the Al-Qaeda branch of Al-Qaeda in Iraq had been crushed. Well, it hadn't been crushed. It had been greatly diminished, and they were underground, but they were still there. And they bided their time. They knew that their worst enemy was the American Special Forces and the American intelligence community in Iraq. That's because the Special Forces, a lot of those operators spoke Arabic. They understood the culture. They were willing to sit around and spend hours drinking tea and discussing the situation with sheikhs and various other tribal and religious leaders. They were respected, and they were knowledgeable. They basically knew what the heck was going on. American intelligence had basically taken that and gone several steps further by collecting vast databases of the individuals and the intertwined relationships of various people in these Arab countries, especially those with Islamic radical proclivities. Now, inside of Iraq, when we had all those special forces and intelligence units there, we basically were the main source of actionable information for the Iraqi army and police. They came to us. I mean, they knew a lot. I mean, they spoke the language. They lived in the community. But they didn't have the analytical tools, and they didn't have the expertise that the Special Forces had. American Special Forces passed on a lot of that expertise to their Iraqi counterparts. But again, there were not that many Iraqis who were interested because it's dangerous work. If you're an Iraqi, they'll go after your family. They can't get to you, et cetera, et cetera. We weren't able to leave a Iraqi special forces that was expert enough and useful enough to replace the American deadlock. And it was even more the case with the intelligence, which had a lot of technical people, which the Iraqis simply didn't have. And there was a lot of technology, algorithms and what have you, specialized software that we never let the Iraqis have, especially source code, but you know, a lot of times not even the executables. We have the control of the black boxes, and if they need something analyzed or whatever, we do it. We pass them on the information. They got what they needed. When our guys were thrown out because the Iraqis wouldn't sign a status of forces agreement, which even then a lot of Iraqis, especially in the military intelligence branches, thought was stupid and self-defeating, well, they proved to be right. And of course now that's changing. But what happened was that allowed the more radical than now Iraqi branch of Al-Qaeda to start growing again. And the Iraqi Al-Qaeda knew that, in fact, they were behind, as it were, stirring up nationalist fervor for not signing the Status of Forces Agreement. You know, that was not hard to interpret. They knew that they could basically work, as it were, more effectively against the Iraqi security forces, which is exactly what they did. Because the biggest thing the Al-Qaeda has in most of these third world countries, as it were, is the local corruption. You can buy anybody. And people are basically venal. They won't stick to the job. They're not as efficient as the Westerners are. And that's the main reason why ISIL seemingly came out of nowhere, and half the a recent analysis that was released when we sent our advisors back in there, you know, several months ago. First thing we did was run around and then did a check of individual units, and sure enough, we found that only about 40% of the brigades in the Iraqi army were worth even training and equipping. The rest of them were basically run by corrupt, incompetent officers. And it was no easy task to replace all of those guys in a hurry. And this is something that terrorists know how to take advantage of. And they do. And what Al-Qaeda has been doing is basically passing this knowledge on either through the internet or, you know, the training. These training camps that you often hear mentioned are often nothing more than a cave or a tent or, you know, a room in some out of the way, you know, part of the country where the franchisees can come to the head office, which is basically an SUV full of guys, you know, who've been, you know, with Al-Qaeda for a long time, and can explain to them, look, this is where it's at right now, and these are the techniques that will win. And basically, as the special forces like to call it, they sit down and drink a lot of tea. In other words, a lot of this stuff is exchanged verbally. It has an advantage in that you can get feedback. In other words, the guy who's learning if he has questions and what have you, he can ask him right then and there. And so this wisdom, as it were, this evil wisdom, was basically passed along. What happened now with ISIL is that ISIL brought out into the open a more intense form of "I'm more Islamic than thou." Al-Qaeda had basically decided 5 or 6 years ago, I mean, this was news, but this kind of news you fall asleep reading, that Al-Qaeda had the best chance of success by playing a long game. In other words, they didn't come right out and say it, but if you talk to a special forces guy or just read, you know, the footnotes and what have you, you realize that Al-Qaeda says, let's take advantage of all this corruption and what have you, because a lot of people in Al-Qaeda do believe that the only way for, you know, to protect Islam and to make, you know, the Islamic world thrive is to rid themselves of these dictators, these basically inept and corrupt and counterproductive leaders that they have. And that's true. I mean, anybody, you know, who looked at it, you know, clearly would say, look, your biggest problem is the corruption, the mismanagement. As aid agencies have now become more aware after decades of people crunching the numbers and saying, look, I'm not making this up. We got 20 years of aid that has basically disappeared into foreign bank accounts. We've got to change the way we do this. Well, Al-Qaeda understood the same thing, and they said, we can take advantage of it because since we are religious, we basically are less corrupt. I mean, there's a lot of corruption in the Islamic terrorist organizations. But, you know, they say, look, we are less corrupt, and we can provide an alternative. Now, this is a lot of Muslims will go along with that, in part because one of the sad aspects of Islamic cultures, countries, is that they have a lower level of education. Now, there's a lot of reasons for that, but basically, you know, The Islamic culture stresses religious education over practical education. And this, you just look at the numbers, you know, the illiteracy, the percentage of graduates who have technical degrees and what have you. There are just far fewer of them proportionately, you know, per million population than there are in the West. Now, this is a dirty little secret within the Islamic world. I don't like to admit this, although there are movements within the Arab world, like the Arab Reform Movement, which is sponsored by no less than the Saudi Arabian government, which is quietly saying, look, the problem is here. It's not from the West. It's basically our inability to be as effective as the West. And so we have to basically clean up our act. This is a hard sell because the corruption is really, you know, firmly embedded. And if you look at the history of the West, which, by the way, used to be as corrupt as the Islamic states, but this was centuries ago, was the West that corrupt? And there were reform. There were several waves of reform. And the discouraging thing about looking at other examples, China, for example, went through periods of corruption and less corruption and what have you. It takes generations, and people don't want to hear that. They say, hey, you know, can we spend a lot of money and make it happen, like, you know, before the next election cycle? You know, and that just doesn't work. So if you're going to play the long game, you know, you're up against a lot of obstacles. Anyway, getting back to ISIL. ISIL attracted all those young, stupid, poorly educated, you know, guys who want to go out and play video games for real to come and go to ISIL. And what happened in Syria, for example, in the beginning, al-Nusra, which is a local Syrian-born, you know, Islamic terrorist organization, they were basically firmly in the camp of al-Qaeda, and their leaders still are. But as ISIL grabbed Mosul in last June, which was a big thing, you know, it's like the airplanes crashing into the towers, World Trade Center towers in New York City in 01, this got a lot of attention, especially of the young and stupid. They said, wow, look at what you can do if you go really, you know, crazy with this ideology. Suddenly the al-Nusra and the secular rebel organizations in Syria all found a lot of the guys individually and then eventually as factions going over to ISIL. Now, this really panicked the heck out of al-Qaeda because they found themselves being replaced as the base by ISIL, which basically wanted to establish a caliphate, which is another fiction which has been popular in the, you know, this is a world government ruling all Muslims and ultimately all people, you know, who will be forced or persuaded or killed if they don't converting to Islam. This has not really existed in a practical sense for over 1,000 years, but hey, don't bother me with, you know, reality like that. Is still very popular. And ISIL now has a caliphate, which is basically many parts, not all, of western Iraq and eastern Syria. It's mostly desert, you know, but hey, it looks big on a map. You know, that little splotch of, you know, whatever color you put that the Islamic State in. And so al-Qaeda knows that they have to compete in the media sphere for attention with ISIL, and what they have been doing, even before ISIL came along, was encouraging branches to set up safe havens where they can train and launch terror attacks locally and in the West, because the West gets the biggest, you know, publicity. And Khorasan, which originally was based in Pakistan and the border area between Pakistan and Afghanistan, was sent, you know, over a year ago to join the al-Nusra under their protection, as it were, and they would basically organize these attacks in the West, which is why they are in the news now, because the United States caught wind of that very quickly and said, oh my God, we got to get these guys. But, you know, our government had decided not to bomb in Syria. And so people were chewing their fingernails saying, oh, here we go again. So the minute that bombing was allowed in Syria, guess who, you know, got nearly half the attacks? Al-Nusra. Because they were a clear and present danger. And that really was released by the Pentagon, you know, never mind, you know, the details of why all of a sudden they've been on the radar, the secret classified radar for a long time. But they are one of many groups around the world. There was one in Somalia, which never really got going because Somalia is so chaotic, even Islamic terrorists find they can't operate there. There's another faction in Yemen, which did launch some attacks, none of them very successful, but they got a lot of news. You know, the shoe bomber, you know, the underpants bomber, you know, all sorts of stuff like that. Al-Qaeda also had a cell basically based in I think mostly in Germany. The Germans are very efficient. They eventually quietly cracked down, arrested a lot of people, especially after 9/11. Same thing in Britain and Spain, two countries where people were saying, hey, you know, come on, let's be multicultural, you know, kumbaya, let's all be happy together. And but as soon as people started getting killed by Islamic terrorist bombs, they wanted some action, and they got it because the police and intelligence organizations saw this stuff coming. But if you can't get any political traction, you're not going to get permission to do anything about it. Well, permission was granted, you know, especially after 2003, even in Saudi Arabia, where Al-Qaeda broke the longstanding truce, as it were, and basically destroyed a longstanding, you know, how should I put it, refuge for Islamic terrorists who happen to be, you know, Saudi citizens. Like, you know, you can always come back, no matter what dirt you've done overseas. If you came home and stayed clean and recuperated or whatever, raised money, that was cool. Just don't do anything. But after 2003, when the United States and Britain went into Iraq, that so outraged Al-Qaeda that they basically said, all right, let's start attacking. Let's basically spoil our own nest and go attacking in Saudi Arabia. And in short, within 2 years, they were all driven into Yemen and other parts of the world. And that's why Yemen became the new center for terrorism. In Arabia, you know, including Iraq and all parts around there, all the Arab countries in the Arabian Peninsula and Syria and what have you. Now that's shifted north up into Syria, and that's why Khorasan was there, and that's why they got hit real hard.
Now, you wrote some stuff this morning on the site about some new stuff that's going, or new, we become aware of it, is stuff going on in Yemen with ISIL and the Sunnis and the Shia and that mess. And basically, there's been some large movements there in Yemen, right?
Yes. This is news that basically would be big news if it weren't for the fact that there is so much else going on in the rest of the world, in Syria and what have you. The Shia minority in Yemen, which is about a third of the population, up until the 1970s, up until about 50 years ago, they had a lot of autonomy. There was basically a Shia kingdom up there for over 1,000 years. And as part of a series of civil wars and reunification of Yemen, which had been split in half since World War II, and it split even more so before that. But that's another story. As Yemen was putting itself back together again as a unitary state, they basically took away the autonomy that the Shias had, and the Shia resented it. They never forget. And they got support from Iran, which Iran always denied, and of course the Yemeni Shia denied, until they basically, again, quietly... They defeated the pro-government Sunni tribes in the north, which were always a minority in the north, which is mainly Shia. By the way, there's a lot of Shia related. This is a different flavor of Shia. But anyway, there's a lot of them. I think even maybe most of them are across the border in Saudi Arabia. But the Saudis have reached an understanding with their Shia on that border area, that if you mess around, we will wipe you out. You know, they behead people and things like that. There's something to be said for that extremism. But anyway, the Yemeni Shia, they just kept at it. Now, the government was distracted for the last 2 or 3 years because Al-Qaeda, again, as part of this new strategy, they basically allied themselves with the southern Sunni tribes. The Sunnis are the majority. They're about 60-70% of the Yemenis. And who are mainly in the south, they wanted to split Yemen again. They wanted an independent or very autonomous, you know, Sunni south. Yemen's always had this problem. It's nothing new. And Yemen, of course, has all that corruption and bad governance and what have you, the usual sad stop story. Anyway, the government found that the separatist Sunnis in the south and the Al-Qaeda, growing Al-Qaeda groups that were being sheltered by these Sunni tribes, because Al-Qaeda is basically Sunni, you know, religious fanatics, were becoming a bigger problem. So they basically tried to put the Shia on the back burner, you know, basically ignored them, insulted them, shot at them only when necessary, reinforced, gave money and guns to the Sunni tribes up there who were taking more and more of a beating. And it came to a head in the middle of 2013 when the Shia up there went after some madrasas, religious schools, which had been training some particularly, radical, Sunni religious leaders and scholars. Who were basically preaching that Shia are scum, et cetera, which is not the sort of thing you do in an area where these Shia are the minority and they all have guns. Anyway, that led to a growing avalanche, as it were, a snowball getting bigger and bigger as it slowly rolled south. And in the last year, the government defeated the Al Qaeda in the south and basically got the tribes quieted down, and so there's a lot less violence down there now. But suddenly the Shia were on the outskirts of the capital, which is up towards the north. Now another thing that complicated this factor was the Saleh, the longtime dictator, the president for life, as it were, of Yemen since I think the 60s. He was corrupt and he basically took care of his own people, but he was a Shia. So he had a special rapport with the Northerners. Now, the guy was basically for sale by anyone, and he would do business. He paid off the Sunnis and what have you. He had a large tribal payroll. But he was forced out in 2012 and replaced by a lot of Sunnis. So suddenly, the government had a lot less juice with the armed Shia. Now, Shia, the Yemen, probably has more guns per capita than the United States, and they carry them openly. They don't worry about is there a carry law in this particular province and what have you. You got a gun, you strut around with it. Yemen has been the center of gun running, smuggling and what have you, for centuries. But anyway, all these people were getting more annoyed, and of course they were heavily armed, and of course on top of that, the Iran was sending cash and guns. Increasingly, these were getting caught because the American was out there with the anti-piracy patrol, and they were able to basically monitor ships coming and going, and they tell the Yemeni Coast Guard, by the way, this ship we tracked from somewhere in Iran, and it's headed for the north coast where your Shia are. You might want to check it out. And so they there were a couple of embarrassing incidents over the last year or so where they captured these innocent trading these dhows, these local coastal trading ships full of weapons and what have you that were all made in Iran. So this became very embarrassing, but this basically kept the Shia going. And in the last month, starting in August, there was thousands of civilian unarmed Shia demonstrators in the capital demonstrating daily in bigger and bigger numbers, for less corruption, for more autonomy for Shia, for a lot of good things that a lot of Sunnis can get behind. But in the last couple of weeks, a lot of Shia started showing up with guns. And in the last, two or three weeks, close to 500 people have been killed. I mean, there's been shooting in the streets. Again, this would be big news if there weren't so many things blowing up in other parts of the world. Suddenly on the 21st, they basically took over the government. Now, it isn't over yet because nothing is simple in Yemen. They basically seized control. That the army and police decided that maybe it was better if we stay out of this, and they literally just stepped back. And suddenly there were Shia manning checkpoints and standing guard in front of a lot of, the TV stations and government bureaucracies. But the government still had people inside those compounds with lots of guns, and they weren't letting the Shia in. So basically the Shia had stalemated the government. The government wasn't doing much of anything. Of course, it never did much of anything, but it was doing less much of anything because of the Shia situation. And they got an agreement on the 22nd, brokered by between the 20th and the 22nd, brokered by the UN, mainly because the airports had been shut down because there was fighting around the airports, and the UN representatives who wanted to leave couldn't because, well, anyway. So they figured, all right, since we're stuck here, let's arrange a deal that nobody will respect, which is what the UN does very well. And they made a peace deal which had the government, the prime minister, who did resign on the 20th, I think 21st, and the president, the new guy, who replaced Saleh, the ex-Shia dictator, he promised that if the Shia left the capital, especially the guys with guns, and went back to the north, which is only 100 or so kilometers north of the capital, they would appoint a new prime minister agreeable to the Shia, and form a new government which would be agreeable to the Shia. Well, the president hasn't moved in over a week, and on the 28th, I think, the Shia said that, look, we're not moving out of the city, the capital, until you basically start keeping your promise. And there it stands, so that this is going to be another civil war, further complicated by the fact that when news of this coup, as it were, reached Iran, there was not quite dancing in the streets, but there was a lot of public displays of victory. Hey, we've won another one. And when Saudi Arabia started having connections, because they always feared, as did the other Sunni Gulf states, which control most of the oil in Arabia, that Iran wanted to establish another Hezbollah, which Iran basically helped form in the 1980s during the 1975 to 1990 Lebanese Civil War, which is based on religious factions. That militia in a country like Yemen, which about a year or only a third of the population, became so powerful that they basically can veto anything the government does, which is the government is dominated by the majority, which is not Shia. But they're so powerful that they can basically veto anything they don't like. And so now Saudi Arabia sees Iran trying to do this with the Yemeni Shia right on their border. The Saudis have let it be known that they will not tolerate this. So this is getting very interesting. Now, the Israelis did go into, like, at one point, they controlled a lot of southern Lebanon, you know, through the 80s and 90s. And finally they said, you know, got tired of it because, you know, it was constant, you know, guerrilla warfare with these, with the Hezbollah, the Shia militias and terrorists. And of course that didn't really solve the problem, as they found out in 2006 when the Hezbollah got really ambitious and kids were really going at it, trying to kidnap Israeli civilians or soldiers and what have you, and that triggered a war which went on for several weeks. And of course you got Hamas doing the same thing in Gaza recently. And the Saudis don't want that sort of nonsense. That's fine if the Jews are involved on the business end of it, but it's not the sort of thing for the Saudi Arabia. And so now we got the prospect of a possible military intervention by Saudi Arabia in Yemen, and even more war. So when and if things die down in Iraq and Syria, which they tend to do it over a while, you can reasonably expect, you know, you're meant to blow up. And, you know, keep a lot of otherwise starving journalists gainfully employed.
Right.
Or at least the headline writers.
Right, yeah. Well, it's a never-ending series of surprises over there, I guess. Now, is ISIL getting mixed up at all in what's going down in Yemen?
Yes. Well, yes and no. ISIL has sent people down there. But the problem in Yemen is that the Al-Qaeda organization is very strong, and they've been so active in terms of blowing things up and assassinating government officials and what have you, that ISIL, you know, beheading innocent civilians, you know, and videoing it, you know, doesn't really do it. You know, in other words, Al-Qaeda has too much wreck, as it were, in Yemen for ISIL to get much traction. But they're trying, because right now they're basically riding this wave of popularity among the, you know, the more fanatic Islamic radicals, and there are basically ISIL groupies, or the ISIL cells, as it were, factions popping up all over the place in North Africa, in Somalia, you name it. You know, there's people say that, hey, I'm a follower of ISIL, it could eventually become a problem. Because the whole business with the Shia versus Sunni is very incendiary. And what's really ironic about this business in Yemen right now is that Saudi Arabia and Iran were making nice together. I mean, they've been at each other's throats increasingly over the last decade because the Iranians are becoming more aggressive in saying, you know, we, Iran, should be the custodians of the holy places, the most holy sanctuaries in Saudi Arabia, Mecca and Medina, and not these Arabs, you know, as it were. This does not go down well in Arabia or in among most Muslims, and it's caused an increasing amount of friction between the Sunnis and the Shia. Now, that basically had mellowed out a bit in the last, you know, 6 months with the threat of ISIL, which basically was going after everybody, you know, not just the more moderate Sunni regimes, which are considered corrupt and et cetera, et cetera. But, of course, a big-time goal of any Sunni Islamic radical is to kill as many Shia as possible. But now what's going to happen with, you know, Iran salivating at the prospect of setting up another dominating militia in Yemen right on the border of Saudi Arabia? I mean, of course, that has problems associated with, because Yemen is the poorest part of Arabia. They have very little oil, and they have a large population. The large population is by virtue of the fact that the most watered place, the place with the best agricultural territory, has always been Yemen. It's been that way for thousands of years because they get some of the monsoon coming across the Indian Ocean. The rest of Arabia does not. But when oil was discovered, there was very little of it down in Yemen. You know, it's just one of those things. But anyway, Lebanon hasn't got much oil either, and Hezbollah has become a major, you know, factor. But, you know, Hezbollah in Yemen won't be going after Israel. They'll be going after Saudi Arabia, which is the big prize. So this could get interesting in bad ways.
Yes. All right. Well, we'll leave it there on that up note. And we'll talk to you next time.
Indeed. Take care.
All right. Bye.